In the book of Job now, today, we want to do two things, basically. We want to begin with the speech of Eliphaz, which comes in chapter 15, and then we want to look at Job's response to it, and we want to focus in particular on the fact that in chapter 16, Job says, I have heard many such things, sorry counselors or sorry comforters are you all. And we want to take some time to determine what is a sorry comforter. And we'll take some time to look about eight things that are in the book of Job that make a person a sorry comforter. Then we'll also want to integrate, as we've done before, this with the book of Proverbs and look at what is a good comforter or a good counselor and integrate the two. So by way of introduction then today, remember we have in the book of Job the dialogue. The dialogue, remember we have in the book of Job prologue, dialogue, and epilogue. The dialogue starts in chapter 3, verse 1, and goes through the bulk of the book, chapter 42 and verse 6. And in the dialogue you have three triads. And the triad is a speech by one of Job's friends, Job's response, another friend, Job's response, and then another friend. And we have the first triad, which we are finished with. The first triad in Job is chapters 4 through chapter 14. And it is made up of the speech of Eliphaz versus Job. And we emphasize that in these speeches, it's Eliphaz versus Job, because this is going to be not just in the context of my side and your side. There's conflict all the way through. So that first one is in 4 through 7. The second one brings onto the scene Bildad versus Job, and that is in 8 through 10. And then the third, which is Zophar, we covered last week, and it's Zophar versus Job, and that is in 11 through 14. And we're through with that, and we're ready now to take the second triad today. And the second triad goes from chapter 15 through chapter 21. And basically, when we open with chapter 15, you've gone through with all three of these speeches, and Job has responded to them very, very clearly. And now, basically, think of Job's friends as sharpening their swords so they can thrust a little deeper. Job's friends never, ever hear Job. Job might as well have talked to a tree than to address these friends, because they never, never, never hear Job. They ignore everything that he says, and they see only their own viewpoint. So we're ready now for the speech of Eliphaz. Back to the first man that spoke in response to Job's response. Speech of Eliphaz, this is his second one. The other thing we ought to say is that Eliphaz speaks once, then he comes back and speaks again, and then he will come back and speak a third time. And the important thing to remember about him is he never changes his tune. We will be going through the second and the third speech of Eliphaz fast. The reason for going through it fast is because he never says anything new. They never budge. They never respond. They never hear Job. They have one tune. Their eyes are closed. And that's all they can say. So Eliphaz will be the same all the way through in chapter 15. Basically, in his charge, he makes two. Let's just divide this into the first charge of Eliphaz and the second charge. They divide off with verse 16. If you're looking at your text, notice that verse 17 of chapter 15 starts a new paragraph. So his first charge is simply this: Job, you have criticized God. You have criticized God. And that is verses 1 through 16. Now, Job's friends, basically, when we come to chapter 15, they do make a shift in their argument, in that you do have a shift in the focus. And the focus of Job's friends up to this point of time has been, Job, look what happened to you. That is a sign that you're sinning. So let's say number one is their argument that the happenings argue for his sin. In other words, the catastrophe that we had described in chapters 1 and 2, which is the loss of his wealth, the loss of his family, and finally the loss of his health, all of those things argue one point. And the point that they argue simply is, you have sinned in some way. You would not have lost your possessions. You would not have lost your family had you not done something. So this all focuses on some kind of act of sin. And they grill him on that. What is it that you have done? How have you sinned to bring all this judgment upon you? However, by the time we get to the second round of arguments, they change their focus. And they say, it's not the happenings that argue your sin, it's your words that argue your sin. So what we have had is these catastrophes happen to Job. And because of the catastrophes, they say that points to some kind of hidden sin somewhere. But they're past that now. They're not arguing. They're not thinking about the things that have happened to Job. They're now thinking of the fact that, what have you said? Your mouth is the root of your sin. In other words, you would not be in such a position as you're in today had you not talked the way you talk. Now let's catch that reading in chapters 15, verses 1 through 6. And you'll catch it when you read through. Chapter 15. Then Eliphaz the Temanite responded, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Just kind of lock that, take a picture of that phrase there in your mind, because it's going to become extremely colorful when we get back to the details. Fill himself, and the thing we want to focus on will be the word himself in Hebrew. Fill himself with the east wind. Should he argue with useless talk or with words which are not profitable? Indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder meditation of God. For your guilt teaches your mouth. And the idea of guilt teaching the mouth is the idea that the mouth expresses inner guilt. The guilt that's really there is expressed via your words. And so notice the emphasis now is not so much that what happened to you argues your sin, but what you're saying argues your sin. So verse 5, your guilt teaches your mouth, and you choose language of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I, and your own lips testify against you. So notice the stress now is not on what have you done, Job, but what have you said. So let's put this. It is now a shift from what have you done to what have you said. It is a shift from what have you done to what have you said. And that is the new tone that will come in through the rest of the book of Proverbs, rather the book of Job. Really, if Job made any mistake in dealing with his friends, here's what it was. He was honest with them. He told them how he really felt. He was honest in the expression of his feelings. If you have lived long enough, you know that one of the serious mistakes that you can make in life many times, and it's unfortunate, one of the serious mistakes you can make in life is open your mouth and tell how you really feel. Because like Job's friends, there are many, many people. Job's friends can never be answered. Job just breaks his neck to say, is there any way I can get you guys to understand what I'm trying to say? And every time he opens his mouth, instead of listening for what Job is saying, they take his words and they use it as fuel for more criticism. And you have that in 15, 1 through 6. So Job really has two options. It's either be honest or be quiet. And unfortunately, Job is honest, and his friends take those words, and he used them no end. Okay, so basically in 1 through 6, Eliphaz is saying, I don't care what your past sins are, your present words are enough to condemn you. Now, noting in a little bit of detail in what Eliphaz says in these first six verses, Eliphaz really becomes coarse. And I know of no other way to make this point except to say he becomes extremely coarse. Now, in our English translations, you would not catch the coarseness of what he says, but you do catch it in the Hebrew text. Look now at verse 1. Then Eliphaz the Temanite responded, "Shall a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself?" And here's what we need to note. The word himself is a translation of a Hebrew word in the original that is the word, Hebrew word, belly. So in verse 2, the latter part, you fill your belly with the east wind. And the idea is, Job, your words are like an excretion of belly wind, or Job is a big burp. That's coarse. But that's literally and exactly in the Hebrew text what Eliphaz is saying of Job. He says, I listened to all of your words that you have said, all of your speeches, and it just is to me like you have just burped. And that's all that I can see. You are a burp. And basically at this point, Eliphaz casts himself into the idea that I am wise, you're the fool, and I'm going to avoid you. One of the interesting things that you come on at this point is there is no nastier person than a self-righteous believer. And this is what, in the midst of all of this suffering, Eliphaz is telling Job. And that's crude language. Here's somebody that has lost their family. They have lost their possessions. They have lost their health. They are devastated. And you are so self-righteous that they are under the judgment of God that you call them a burp. And this reflects the nastiness that comes into this. And I think there's no other way to say it is that Eliphaz is really coarse at this point in his criticism of Job. But furthermore, you have two criticisms that follow in the text. And the two criticisms are, number one, Job, you are stupid. This becomes very strong. Job, you are stupid. Verses 1 through 3. Notice the third verse especially. And isn't this saying, you know, you're doing a stupid thing. He says, should he argue with useless talk or with words which are not profitable? And that, in our English idiom, is simply saying, Job, you're doing a very stupid thing. The second thing, and it gets much stronger, is not only, Job, are you stupid, but you are dangerous. You're stupid, but there's more to that. You are dangerous to everyone else. And that is found in verse 4. Very strong words. Indeed, you do away with reverence, and you hinder meditation before God. And that's the point at which you just love to poke Eliphaz right in the mouth. Because here he is saying, Job, you are a hindrance to my fellowship with God. I can't meditate on truth because of you. And you're blocking the way. So you're not just a stupid person. You're very dangerous and you're hurting others is the thrust that you get into this this scene. Now, when you come down to verses 5 and 6, up till this point, all of the criticism of Job's friends about his suffering has been sort of shots in the dark. Now, coming down to 5 and 6, they get specific. So let's come down to the specific charge. By the way, just to focus on that, go back to chapter 6 and notice that they know and Job knows that they haven't been specific. They've been shooting in the dark. After the first line of criticism in chapter 6, verse 24, Job says, "Teach me, and I will be silent." In other words, if you can give me information to quiet me, I welcome it. Show me how I have erred. And in response to that, they have nothing. They can give no way where they can show where Job has erred. Honest words are not painful. But what does your argument prove? Do you intend to reprove my words when the words of one in despair belong to the wind? In other words, he's simply saying you've got no specific charge. However, when you come to chapter 15, they feel they've got one. And the specific charge is going to focus around what we have in chapter 15. And in chapter 15, it is going to be the specific charge is your words, your speech. What comes out your mouth is what condemns you. Notice verse 5. It says, "For your guilt teaches your mouth, and you choose the language of the crafty." Notice how they're being specific now. They're not shooting in the air. They're not shooting in the wind. Verse 6, "Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Your own lips testify against you." So you now get a specific charge, and the specific charge is basically his words. Then notice in the following verses 7 through 10, you get sort of a barrage of just humiliating questions. Reading them is clear. Verse 7, "Were you the first man to be born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Do you hear the secret counsel of God and limit wisdom to yourself?" In other words, are you the only one that knows the answers? Now, first question, had Job ever said that? Had Job ever said, "I'm the only one that has the answers"? Go back to chapter 12 and verse 3. Job had said, "I know as much as you." Chapter 12, verse 3. He says, "I have intelligence as well as you." Is he saying that I'm the only person in the world that knows? He didn't say that. He said, "I know as much as you know. I am not inferior to you. As a matter of fact, who does not know such things as these?" In other words, the knowledge that I have is equal to yours, and there are a lot of other people that know the same thing. It's common knowledge. And yet, in chapter 15, how does Eliphaz twist that? He twists that down in verse 7 as though Job is saying, "I'm the only man in the world that has understanding." So, the point we want to make is Job's words are exaggerated. Job's words are exaggerated. And I'll put 12:3 coupled with 15:7. What they say he says in chapter 15 is not what he really says. What they're really saying is that, "Job, you think you're the only person that has any understanding." And what Job has really said is that my words, your understanding, and mine, I understand the situation as well as you do, and there are a lot of other people that also understand the situation. And so Job is really saying, we're all on the same level. They exaggerate his words beyond what he ever said. Now let's make a couple of observations coming off of what we have coming down in these verses. And it will be generalizations about what Job's friends are going to say. And I think you've already got the thrust from reading so far that Job's friends were really self-righteous, bigoted people. And therefore, what we can conclude about them, we can conclude about anyone who is self-righteous. For sake of brevity, I'm going to put SR, meaning self-righteous. The self-righteous accept only their own evaluation of another person. The self-righteous accept only their evaluation of Job. And I could not emphasize more strongly the fact that Job will speak and he will speak at length and they never hear him. Because they are locked in that we know the answers, our evaluation is correct, and that is it, period. That's the end of the sentence. There is no evaluation that can be accepted except ours. In other words, we have listened to you, we have met in committee, and the committee has decided that we have an evaluation of you, Job, and that's it. We have no ears, and that is typical of self-righteousness. It makes an evaluation and allows for no input except for from itself. The second observation is when you have a self-righteous evaluation, in what terms do you put it? Self-righteous evaluation is always pious. It is always pious. It is always the idea that, Job, we evaluate you in line with our responsibility to God. We represent Him, and if we are harsh, it is only because we are the reps of God. We are His sent people, and they put it in pious terms. Look at verse 7. Were you the first man to be born? Isn't that a very pious rebuke of pride? Were you brought forth before the hills? Do you hear the secret counsel of God and limit yourself to wisdom? What do you know that we do not know? And what do you understand that we do not? Both the gray-haired and the aged are among us. So now we're going to parade the gray hair and say that, don't you have any respect for age? And they will bring this in. And they will come to the fact that, verse 11, are the consolations of God too small for you? And that's pious, isn't it? Isn't God big enough to help you? That's the way self-righteousness always reads. It is always pious. It always drips. As I recall in seminary, the professor saying, whenever you hear somebody preach more than three Sundays on thou shalt not steal, he's stealing. And the emphasis was that the piety that is there is often used to cover. And that brings us to another observation, is that the most effective way to divert attention from your guilt is what? Make an accusation. So, accuse another of that of which you are guilty. Accuse another of that which you are guilty. And Job's friends do nothing but accuse. And that's effective. If you are sinning in a certain area and you feel like you might get some heat for it, then what's a clever psychological trick to pull? Start pointing out to your friends other people who are committing that same sin, and you have shifted the focus from yourself to others. And it's a clever trick, and Job's friends go do it all the way through. Now, there's an interesting thing. What Job's friends accuse him of, Job will later be accused of by God. Now, what's the difference? Job's friends will put their finger on some things that God will condemn them for pointing out. And yet God will turn around and will accuse them of the accuse Job of the same thing. What's the difference? In other words, we're not saying that Job's friends may not be right in some of their accusations, and yet they're going to be condemned for it. What is the difference? Well, the difference is this: is their evaluation assumes something that God's did not, or that God's evaluation can. Their evaluation assumes omniscience. And of course, when God accuses Job of the same thing, it doesn't need to assume omniscience because He is omniscient. He does know all things. And you get this flavor all the way through, is that we know, we understand, we have the answers, and it makes that assumption all the way through. All right? Notice down now to verse 14. Not only are Job's friends blind to Job, they're also blind to themselves. They don't see Job's problem. They don't see theirs. Notice verse 14 makes this clear. What is man that he should be pure? Or he who is born of a woman that he should be righteous? And the question you want to ask at that point is, look, aren't you guys born of a woman too? And they don't see that. They don't see themselves in any way. You want to say at verse 14, well, people who are born of woman Eliphaz, aren't you one of them? Or were you hatched from an egg? Or better yet, Eliphaz, did you crawl out from underneath a rock? Why do you exclude yourself? Which he does, and does very effectively in this context. Completely blind to their own condition. Now, they've got a counterpart, and let's look at it in John chapter 9 in the New Testament. The counterpart to Job's friends. Very interesting counterpart. In the New Testament, John chapter 9. Remember, Job's friends have the tunnel vision theology that says if there's suffering, you can sniff out sin. If there is suffering, if there's heartache, there's got to be some kind of sin behind it. And notice that is passed on. These are the ancestors of the Eliphazes and the Bildads and the Zophars. It says, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. Now take the mentality of Job's friends, and the minute you see a man blind from birth, there is suffering, therefore there's got to be sin. And notice they do that in verse 2. His disciples ask him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? See how wide their vision of what is the cause of suffering? I mean, it's there, therefore it's got to be sin. And notice in verse 3, the Lord rebukes it by saying it was neither the man that sinned nor his parents, but there's another reason for suffering, and he explains what that reason is. In the context, the man is healed, and the Pharisees see the man in their self-righteousness, and you come down to chapter 9 and verse 34. The man is trying to teach and tell them that Jesus has healed me, and they are the self-righteous Pharisee class, and they answered and said to him, you were born entirely in sins. Are you teaching us? Now, what are they blind to? When they say you were born entirely in sins, weren't they? Sure they were. Do they see that? No, they don't. Because they're the self-righteous. And therefore, because of their self-righteous position, they are becoming, in verse 34, absolutely, totally unteachable. And so let's put it down as a point because it is an important one. And that is self-righteousness makes one unteachable. Self-righteousness makes one unteachable. In other words, you can get so good that you don't need to learn. You can know so much that you don't need to learn anymore. And in this particular context, you've got it with Job's friends shown over and over again. There is not one thing in the book of Job that his friends ever learn. Why can't they learn? Why are they unteachable? Because they're too good. They're too busy looking in the mirror and saying, look at us, we stand for righteousness, and consequently they never learn anything. Notice also, closing out John chapter 9 and verse 41, Jesus finally approaches these Pharisees, last verse of the chapter, and Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see, your sin remains. In other words, their self-righteousness covered the fact that they really saw nothing. All right, let's go back now. We've got time enough to look at our second charge. The first one is you've criticized God, verses 1 through 16. And now let's look at the second charge. And the second charge is Job, you have forgotten the fate of the wicked. You have forgotten the fate of the wicked. And that is in verses 17 on to the end of the chapter. And the fact that that is a theme, we can read with basically no need to comment on it because you can see it. Go to Job chapter 15, 17 through 35. Do you see any ego in verse 17? I will tell you, listen to me. And at the end of the book, God is going to come on hard with His wrath on that kind of attitude. And it's the attitude that we have all the answers. I will tell you, listen to me, and what I have seen I will declare. Remember, Eliphaz is the experienced man. What wise men have told and have not concealed from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them. The wicked man, now notice the thrust now, is the fate of the wicked. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days. Is that realistic? Is that true? What do you see? What are you going to see out there Monday morning? All those that disobey God are going to be writhing all week, right? Drive out to the plaza. Go to Fedora and watch them writhe. Are they writhing in pain? No, not at all. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days, and numbered are the years stored up for the ruthless. The wicked die young, right? Is that true? Verse 21, sounds of terror are in his ears. While at peace, the destroyer comes upon him. He does not believe that he will return from darkness. He is destined for the sword. He wanders about for food, saying, where is it? Is that reality of life? If you live a life that disregards God, you will go from door to door begging for food. All beggars are wicked men, right? Yeah, a very unrealistic view. But basically, he is saying, look at the fate of the wicked and what is happening to them. Basically, Eliphaz accuses Job of being a windbag, and basically that's what Eliphaz is all the way through. Now, let's add one thing to this. Who is really, and we may have lost sight of it, who is really behind the words of Eliphaz? How do we start the book of Job? We started the book of Job with Satan saying to God, look, if you take everything away from Job that he's got, he'll swear in your face. And God says, no, he won't. We'll test it out. So really, behind the words of his friends is the activity of Satan. And if you were going to be attacked by Satan, is this the avenue you'd expect to be attacked by? Self-righteous people giving you advice? In Ephesians chapter 6, we have the fact that Satan shoots the believer with the fiery darts of the wicked one. What are the fiery darts in the book of Job? Pious words, pious advice. And so Satan is behind all of this. And we also noted the fact that, going back to our survey on Satan, some couple of sessions ago, we noted two things about him. Number one, his name, devil, which is Greek diabolos, that means what? Remember? Accuser. What are the friends of Job doing all the way through? They're accusing. And his work, again, Revelation 12 says that Satan accuses the brethren before God night and day. Is it possible for a self-righteous person to take truths of Scripture and use them as the darts of the devil? Of course not. If you use a Bible verse, it's always used rightly, correct? Remember, we had in the book of Proverbs a remark that it says, what happens when you get a proverb in the hand of a fool? Remember the metaphor used there? The metaphor is, it's like putting a weapon in the hand of a drunk. Who knows who and what he will shoot next? And he says, when you get a proverb that is a bit of God's truth in the hand of a fool, who knows what he will do with it? And Job's friends are doing that very actively, and Job effectively is going to resist it. But we'll find in our next session, when we come to chapter 16, that we've had a shift. Job is no longer suffering at the hands of circumstances. He is now saying, my greatest suffering in life is my, quote, friends, end quote. And that is much worse than all the calamity that has come upon him. In other words, the boils of Job did not hurt nearly as badly as the friends of Job. Father, we're thankful for your word. May we understand it in order to obey it. In Christ's name, amen.